Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had
Welcome to Big Section Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. We have S&P futures. We have an update. We had a down day yesterday, so we've got to be up today by the dip. We all know that. S&P futures up 15. NASDAQ futures up 217. Again, yesterday morning we were down really heavy. During the day, during the close, it was just a question. If we'd open another hour, we'd have been up on the day. Just continues to be resilient. There's an article here this morning regarding how AI and people are still, the consumer is still resilient and so forth, and I just, I do wish somebody would take note of the fact that when inflation's higher, people spend as much or more than they did before, just sort of on different things, and the quality of life drops even though the gross numbers stay the same or may even go a little bit higher. I don't think that that's getting much of a message, but do we have Professor Kevin? Kevin, are you with us? I don't hear him. Anyway, the oil prices are at 102.24. Yesterday was a little bit. There was a little bit of a tell on yesterday. Not enough where you would say, "Hey, we got to short the market." Because shorting the market's not been so hot. For anybody lately. Even though a lot of stocks have not moved, it's really been very concentrated. It's been the chip companies. It's been those kinds of places. But the day before, when you saw the interest rates creeping up and you saw the VIX creeping up on an up day, that's usually enough to sniff a little bit that maybe at least the rally is over for a day or so. And it was. And I'll put us back today. So we'll see what happens today. But I think the 30-year at...
For a day or so, huh?
Yeah, for a day or so. But the 30-year over 5% is a warning, Kevin. We've got the highest mortgage levels in 5 weeks, but it's we'll see today. We've got the interest rates are unchanged, but yesterday we were up to 5.03 on the 30 and 4.46 on the 10. The 10 has not made it to 4.5 yet, but and I don't think it will today, but they've been creeping. They've just been creeping some, and those are not good. I don't see how they don't listen to a YouTube thing. I sent it to you, but it's kind of long-winded. But there's this economic group now that I listen to on YouTube a little bit. And I'm kind of curious as to where they get their, maybe it's a Carl question or maybe Russell will know. But when you go look and see what the amount of money that foreign countries invest here. And, we're like 40 to 45% of our investments in U.S. Treasury from foreign countries. So I'm always saying be aware that if the whatever's going on in Iran hurts the people that are investing in us to keep us afloat, for those that maybe don't realize it, it's for the last, like a really long time, the U.S. is pretty much overspent vis-a-vis taxes and spending. Not making policy issues on what should be different or better, but it's basically been funded by some people here, but a lot of people not here. A lot of countries have traditionally invested a lot in the U.S. They essentially floated our balloon, for lack of a better term. And China used to be the biggest. Now they've cut back pretty dramatically. And Japan is now the biggest. UK, I believe, is second. But it's a group that if they all of a sudden start cutting back, one of the countries that's been hurt probably more significantly in terms of allies by the Iran situation is Japan, because they import virtually all their oil. Read World War II. That's why they started, going down to the South China Sea, was to get oil. I mean, nothing's changed for those guys. I'm not saying they're going to go blast them. They're not. But the and this somehow or another, this group or this lady have statistics as to last week. And they claim last week, I mean, we mentioned on the show one day, just in passing, that the Japanese yen was going downhill vis-a-vis the dollar, because oil is always exchanged in dollars. So Japan, to buy oil, has to convert the yen to dollars to buy the oil. Well, the yen is dropping like a rock against the dollar, so it's really a double hit for those guys. So it's not just the price of oil going up, it's the fact that they need more yen to get the dollar. As a matter of fact, the yen is, look at it right now, I think it's like 157 versus the dollar. Now, you got to be careful. This is yen per dollar. It's not dollar per euro. So when the euro is, we say it's 117, that means the euro is worth $1.17 versus our dollar at a buck. The yen's the other way. It's how many yen per dollar. So when the yen number goes up, it means the yen is going down. So traditionally, when they get to the 160 per dollar mark, they panic. Well, they do something about it. I won't say panic. I did say panic, but I shouldn't have. They start essentially using their dollar reserves to buy the yen. And evidently, last week, they bought $55 billion worth of yen. And in order to do that, how these people found out these numbers, I don't know, because I couldn't find them. They claim that they sold $8.5 billion worth of treasuries, which you might say, well, geez, they got like a trillion of it. What's the difference? But these kinds of things, if they start to become routine, Kevin, you always say it's a little bit at a time and then suddenly type of thing. So it's
gradually, then suddenly, yeah.
Yeah, and so I mean, you look at the stuff, and it's not like you're going to short the market today, but you look at it, and it's also kind of troubling, Kevin, and you wonder what, where it all is, and you look at this Micron yesterday was up, stock has been straight up, it's been geometric. And yesterday it was down $80, now came back 40, and now it's up 40 today. So there's buy the dips in Micron, and the company's got, they're $50 a share in revenue, so they're like 15 times revenue, for God's sake. And I don't know the ins and outs of who's going to be the big winner here, whether it's going to be Micron or whether it's going to be Intel or whether it's going to be AMD or whether it's going to be Nvidia. But I don't know how they all win. But Kevin, hey, without jumping on you,
I think it's really weird that someone can look at a company or the market, let's just say the market in general, can look at a company and decide that it is worth so much less in 1 or 2 days' time, and then say, "Oh wait, never mind, it's back to where it was. It's okay." That would be weird individual behavior. It seems a little strange as macro behavior too.
Well, you get a lot of you use the term momentum trading. We have people in PTI that trade in our electronic platform. That Kevin, I hear because we can see people trading. Somebody's trading some stock for like the first time, and you're like, Why? I mean, it's not my business. It's their money, but you'll say, but there's all you do. You can Google 10 most active stocks today, and they'll come up. And when they're trading, when they're going up, I don't think people even know what the hell the company does. They don't care. It's up or it's down. It's momentum stuff. It's been up. Something must be going on. It's on everybody's radar. I pick on Micron because this is about the third or fourth time it's done this in my lifetime in the business. I mean, we're talking about a stock that was $420 on April 6th, and now it's $808. Well, somebody, because it's going up every day, people buy it because it's going up. And by the way, the people that have been doing that lately have done very well, so it's not up to me to... I mean, it's not like it isn't a powerful force. It is. But I'm going to say, if 1 out of 100 did any of the calculations I did on PE or revenue per share, I'd be surprised. I mean, I'd be stunned. That doesn't mean if they didn't make money, they sure as hell did. I mean, yesterday I think it traded maybe 720. Now it's, if I can find yesterday's trade, where were we? 511 was yesterday. Well, no, it's 511. Anyway, it was down $80 yesterday. So it closed on Friday night, which would have been the 8th. I'll find it here. I mean, I got the weekly chart here. Wait a minute. Let me get the yearly. Anyway, yeah, Kevin, there's a lot of reasons why people do this. And you see people zeroing in on a stock. They don't even, I mean, maybe I'm, I think it was 746 Friday night. On Monday, it was up over 800. And then yesterday, it traded. It was 795. It closed Monday night. It must have traded like 720 yesterday or something. At one point, and then it closed at 766, and now it's back over 800. I mean, we're talking, there's a billion one shares outstanding. $50 is $55 billion in market cap. Well, hell, 20 years ago, that was a good-sized company, right? We're talking about that kind of movement in a day. I mean, when you see NVIDIA move $6, there's 25 billion shares outstanding. God's sake, it's $150 billion. That's kind of a, I mean, does anybody even, I mean, if your P.E. ratio should be, say, 10, which none of them will be, that's another $15 billion the place has got to make, right? They're not making that. It gets to be crazy, and a lot of it has to do with what Hal's talking about, the ease of getting margin. Now, the Fed's never going to do this, but why something like Micron is still 50% marginable when it's moving at those numbers, I have no idea. But I would move Newton, and I'd pick. I would say, given where the market is, that you need to put up 60% or something, 55. I'm not going to say 100, but we're not doing anything like that. There's no common sense anyplace. Just saying. What's the story with this? I almost was going to get into the Blue Book manufacturer with the. What happened with this hack of college? I thought those guys. I haven't heard of one of these hacks in a while. I mean, I know they hacked the pipeline one time and did something else. They've been.
Oh no, there's. I keep track of the major company hacks all the time. There's something like every week, it seems.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Why does it hit the news?
Yeah. I use them as examples in the classroom all the time. So it's I'm after it. But yeah, the Canvas hack was a real pain in the butt. I'm not sure how it's going to shake out. For anybody who, just to provide some background, Canvas is a learning management system. It has 41% of the share of that market. There are other competitors, but Canvas is the dominant player. They have almost just short of 9,000 schools, ranging from grade levels ranging from kindergarten to graduate school. So it's
really
it's very widely used. Oh yeah, and. What I'll do is, my syllabus is in there, and all of these things are linked together, which is really sweet. It's great the way it works. We build in our assignments. We have put our assignments into different modules. So if you're doing an 8-week course, then you have module 1, module 2 through 8. And assignments, readings, all of that kind of stuff is embedded in Canvas. And also your exams, anything that you want to do. Students will submit their work into Canvas. So it's pretty much guiding, it guides my way through a course. I do a lot of customization with it. So I'll get like the statewide version of the course and then I'll tweak it accordingly, to my own standards, because I can teach a course, an Ivy Tech course, any way as I want, as long as I meet the stated learning objectives, which are usually 8 to 10 learning objectives per course. As long as I meet those, nobody cares how I do it. First of all, on Thursday, it was compromised.
Now, well, back up a second. Now, does the school pays a flat fee for this for everybody to use it, or is every teacher?
Yeah, we pay a fee. You can put your own brand name on it. Ours is Ivy Learn. Not everybody will refer to it as Canvas, but it is Canvas, and that's not unusual for any types of these software as a service type of
system. Give us a number. What does Ivy pay for this? $50? $1 million? Somewhere in the middle?
I haven't a clue. I'm sure it's a big number because we have tens of thousands of students. So.
Well, because the students get in it as well. Okay, not just
The students log into it. And, you know, but the permissions that they have versus the permissions that I have as a professor versus the permissions somebody would have as an administrator are all different. That's normal for any kind of this web-based software as a service stuff, whether it's Salesforce.com or an ERP system like SAP or Dynamics 365 ERP, any of those types of services, they all essentially have the same kind of structure to it.
Does anybody do it the old-fashioned way, just hand out the crap?
No.
I'm just asking.
Do I ever go into the classroom with handouts? Yeah, on occasion. But mostly I push them out that way. You know, there's an announcement section. If I'm teaching a Zoom version of a class, you can go put all your Zoom links right in there. It'll auto-generate them for you, and so that they're ready to go for each class. It's a pretty sweet tool, and I'm not sure, you know, Larissa will have, you know, they'll be able to tell you what they use, and if I were to guess, at least one of them is using Canvas, and maybe both of them. So at any rate, now, the typical setup for each of these is that the service provider will run instances of it. By that I mean they could run a separate instance of it for every school on there. More likely, they have instance number one has 20 schools on there. Instance number two has another 20 or 50 or whatever the whatever a practical number is. And so my first question, and I don't have answers to any of this stuff. This is the kind of stuff that will come out eventually when the story is fully told. But I don't know if one instance was compromised, if everything was compromised. I couldn't tell you. So one of the things I did, you know, seizing the moment, of course, because the breach was discovered on Thursday late afternoon and the system was back online Friday morning about 9 o'clock. Well, I had Saturday morning class, so of course I was going to get into this in detail in Saturday morning class. And I tried to walk my students through it from the chief information officer perspective. What would you be doing once this is recognized so that they understand that process? And so my first question is, one instance compromised or are they all? But if one's compromised, the first thing I'm going to do is say, shut everything down until we know what's going on. So you shut everything down. And you should have, and, you know, everybody's got a plan for this. There's, you know, this is...
But every student's got this thing on their laptop.
Yeah, it's actually, you run it out of your browser. So, you know, you run it out of Chrome or Edge or something like that. So you're just accessing it on the web, just like everybody, like any other application that you run.
So you got to sign in to get in your class.
Yes.
Okay. I've never seen it.
And when I sign in, all of my classes show up there, including something that if I were developing a class, the shell for that's going to be there too. So all of that shows up. And again, as professor, I have permissions to look at everybody's grade book. Students only have permissions to look at their own grade books. So these are all, you know, just what you think, you know, it's basically what do you think would be the case? And then, of course that is the case. So that's essentially how I would look at it.
Do universities do this on their own originally, and then they just all bought into this system, or were they there from day one?
No, when I first started, I'm trying to remember the name of the system we used when I first started before we shifted over to Canvas. But yeah, they've been using it for a long time, so I would have to go back 30 years to when I was teaching banking law at Lake Michigan College. They weren't using a learning management system then. So somewhere along the line, it came into vogue.
I think Jessica told me when she was at DePaul, all the communication back and forth to professors was on Facebook.
Well,
I don't think there was tests. I don't think there were tests and stuff on there, but, you know, scheduled classes, if one got canceled or anything like that, it was all, they communicated by Facebook. That's kind of weird, isn't it?
No, this, yeah, but I'll tell you what, that's not what I do. First of all, there's an announcements feature in there, so I can post an announcement that goes to the whole class.
Okay.
And I do that on a regular basis. But there, and they can respond to it, too. They can respond in line, like it's a live discussion. So if somebody has a response to something, it might be what's on other students' mind, too. So it's not a bad thing. So we have that. Then the part two is that it has a mail function built into it. So and so I have it set up so that it will send email. You know, I can choose to send email to all of my students or some of my students, but when you use the mail function in Canvas, it puts the course information on the in the subject line of the email. So when I get a response from a student, which
somebody just hacked Kevin. That's not good. Andrew, did you just hack Kevin?
Wasn't me. I don't have the skills to do that, unfortunately.
Yes. Messages from my students, because I don't ever want to miss messages from my students. If they need to talk to me or they need to reach out to me, I don't want that to get buried in my normal inbox. Okay, but we digress. So the, as a CIO, that's the first thing you're going to do is you're going to say, okay, what, you know, what's the damage here? And then what do I have to do to get back online? Do I have to go in, I find the vulnerability that was exploited, and then I go back online, and when I'm back online, you know, I can, I would probably enable one instance and see how it goes, and I'd enable a few more and see how it goes, and then I'd open up everything. And then you have to watch to make sure that they don't come back. So that's sort of your process. Now, where this got to be a real problem for a lot of students is many of them, and because it, you know, this is a strategically timed time of year to actually do this. This gets to be a problem for a lot of students because many of them have to take proctored final exams. And so, like in our case, you could take a proctored final exam in the classroom, which means, you know, everybody's there and the professor is in the front of the room and walks around. And I think Hal was talking about that yesterday, that he hates doing that. But a lot of proctored exams go through a testing center at your college and at your campus. And the testing center administers the exam. So you have to make an appointment well in advance to get on the schedule for the testing center. And if your appointment was last Thursday, Thursday evening, Friday morning, and the testing center couldn't handle it, then all of a sudden we got a crunch. We got a bunch of people who can't take their final exam, and getting rescheduled at the testing center means, you know, might mean that you have to extend the time when the grades are due.
So you don't just do it in the regular classroom with the guy standing up in front.
Right. And in some cases, you know, students are taking online classes and so on. So they, you know, they can't take it in a regular classroom. They, you know, you might, if you're taking an online class, you might have students from, you know, campuses all over the state.
But people bring they're doing the test on their computer, to write it out like we used to. Or
well,
either
when you're yeah, you'll do it on your computer. When so when you go to the testing center, they actually will make sure that your pockets are empty, you know, everything that you have, they'll put in a locker. They give you the key, and then you go in and you log into one of their computers, and they enable the test for you.
That's like taking a Series 7 or something like that.
Yeah, and it's the same thing as for a certification test. That's exactly how it works. So, you know, if I want to go take a certification an AI certification or something like that, for example, I would go to the testing center and make sure that I surrender all my valuables and then take the exam and kick its ass and then say thank you, everybody,
yeah, well,
and leave.
Whenever you hit the button to see whether you pass or not, that's always a tough minute.
Yeah, unless you're prepared.
Well, so these guys, whoever they are, hack in and they call it up and say, hey, would you like to see your stuff running again? It's like $5 million, something along those lines.
They threatened for ransom. Otherwise, they threatened to release a lot of student information for your college. So they were encouraging individual colleges to pay up. Now, the kind of student information that's on there is somewhat limited, but not entirely limited. So certainly, you know, things like grades are on there. Student name, student's college email is on there. But there is nothing about addresses or, any of that kind of information. So there is personal information that you wouldn't want released, but it's not a full identity type of thing.
Well, this is a
central... and all of the other student records are separate from it.
Well, this is a century ago computer world, but yours truly was actually on the hacking. You ever go to one of those days, Kevin, where you're in line and they ask for a volunteer and you didn't hear what they said and everybody else stepped back and you were like in front? That would happen to me.
Yeah.
It happened to me on the board, and I was on the board representative to the group of four or five people that were the deep, dark people in IT that analyzed all the hacks and everything. Then there's me in the room. Right? So you can imagine. But I tell you what, it was fascinating. But even back then, they sort of always, this is 1997, 8, the SIBO, they ended up getting, somebody tried to hack in like 3-4 times a week. And people would just go in and they try and wander their way up, and if they couldn't find their way up, then they just dash and go somewhere else. They always seemed to know, Kevin, where it was coming from. At that time, it was from people in Finland and in Sweden. They were, young people just out for a laugh. It wasn't anything like what you're talking about here, but they would work their way in and try a bunch of different codes and work their way up, and if the thing was secure, they'd back out and go somewhere else. This happened, like, all the time, to the point
it did happen all the time, and in fact, if I were to fast forward from there, but take the Wayback Machine from today, I used to get in the morning and look at the security reports first thing every morning, and in my Better World Books days, because it was an online retailer, a really, really light day might be, 80 attempts to get in, that would show up on our reports. A really, really heavy day or a heavier day might be 8,000, and a really heavy day might be 80,000 attempts. Because this is, you can launch automated attacks and just have a lot of computers probing and probing and probing and seeing if you can get in. That's not whatever scared me. If I saw a big day, I'd say, that's kind of interesting. Glad we blocked all that stuff. But your system can only report what it recognizes. So what would keep me up at night is the idea that it might not recognize something, and I might be compromised like that.
Well, it seemed like back in the day, you sort of knew where it was coming from. Matter of fact, somebody came in and gave a presentation one day selling us a system, and I don't think we bought it so long ago. Or if somebody tried to hack in, you'd hack back. But
I had, in one instance, I had a network engineer who did just that. He blasted back some information, told a whole bot network to execute a tight loop system nonstop, for 99 years, and it just shut off the whole denial of service attack.
Well,
not for long. They had to reboot everything, though.
Well, so now today, how is it, since we're supposed to be so sophisticated and our law enforcement supposed to be so sophisticated, how is it that somebody get in there, do all this stuff, communicate with people essentially for a ransom, get paid, and not be discovered? How do you do all that without somebody finding you?
Yeah, and they will be discovered. Before I answer that question, one real quick note. I happen to be sitting in the parking lot of the RV Hall of Fame, and after I get off with you, I'm going to go in because it is the annual career quest where they bus in 7th graders from every school in the area in serial, serially. So they come and go all morning and into the afternoon, and cybersecurity is exactly what I'm going to have on display at our table, and I'm going to have up a live display from one of the I haven't chosen which one yet, but at one of the providers of security services, they'll have a live map of, you know, hacks happening in real time, and you'll be able to follow these lines from one country to the next, within one country and so on. They know exactly where the source is, by IP address, but that doesn't mean anything. Now, as far as how they get in, first of all, they're going to ask to be paid in cryptocurrency. This is what happened with the Colonial Pipeline roughly 5 years ago. They paid the ransom in cryptocurrency, and then the feds chased it down because one of the untrue assumptions is that cryptocurrencies are anonymous. Well, you know, that's not how blockchain works. Blockchain has everything is traceable. So ownership of a cryptocurrency wallet might be disguised. But so once the payment lands in the cryptocurrency wallet, somebody has it. However, if you're going to do anything with that money before the feds or somebody else chases it down and gets your account locked or whatever they do to freeze it, you have to liquidate that. You have to turn the cryptocurrency into dollars or some other currency, some other legit currency. And if you just can't do that fast enough. So whatever they get paid, whatever they think they're going to get paid, they're not going to get it all. They're just betting that they can get enough to make it worth their while, that they can get enough out of the system to make it worth their while.
Yeah, because it has to pop out someplace, right?
Yeah, so what you have to do is you have to find somebody who is willing to pay you, is willing to pay you cash for coin.
Well, what if you keep it in the system? I don't want to wander off too far here, but it seems to me that if I bought, say a car in Bitcoin, if the guy who made the car was able to buy the tires, the motor, the transmission, all that stuff with Bitcoin and became a closed loop, it'd be sort of hard to find, but any place he needs to pay cash for the tires, it has to pop out someplace, right? But yeah. If you stay in the loop, can you still find it? I guess is my question.
Sure. Yeah, you can trace anything that's on a blockchain can be traced step by step by step right back to the origin.
So I guess my stupid question is, whoever this guy is, say it's Andrew, and Andrew decides he's going to keep it.
Damn it, Andrew.
Yeah, he's going to keep it in Bitcoin, and he's going to buy diamonds from some guy in Amsterdam, and he flies over and he takes the diamonds and put them in his pocket. Now you can trace it to the diamond guy, but how do you know where Andrew is with the diamonds?
That's a good question, and that's what they're betting they can get accomplished before they get caught, before they get their money taken away from.
Because it may not pop out in currency. If somebody's willing to take the Bitcoin, they know it's tarnished. Obviously, the diamond dealer is liable to get a visit, which is a problem for him. But and then what happens to him?
Oh, he could be SOL.
So you can say if somebody ships you Bitcoin for diamonds, and you give the guy the diamonds, somehow that's illegal? Maybe it ought to be, but I don't. Is it?
Yeah, you know what? That ask Lou to prep that for you as an attorney. For tomorrow, because I can't tell you where the legality stops. Because one of the problems that you have with cryptocurrencies is they aren't just sitting in one country. Now, I mean, you have multi-country jurisdictions here, and so each one is going to have its own laws, rules, and enforcement capabilities.
But I don't want to get goofy, where I already am, but suppose I did this and I've got $5,000 in Bitcoin. Well, so there was a time, and I don't think they actually went through with it, where Burger King said they're going to take Bitcoin. Well, if I live another 40 years, what if I just buy 5 Whoppers a week? We could use it at Burger King. How's Burger King going to know where it came from, that it's bad Bitcoin?
Burger King's not going to know where it came from.
All right.
And there's no due diligence laws that say, you know, they have to investigate the source. There may be for large items in some countries, but I don't know. I mean, that again, it's where's the transaction take place? whose jurisdiction is that, what are the laws, and how willing and able are they to enforce them. This is one of the problems of really anything that's internet-based and any kind of internet regulation. People talk about internet regulation all the time, but how is it regulated in the EU versus Australia versus the United States versus Japan? Regulation in the U.S. could only affect U.S. commerce, and so much U.S., of what you would consider U.S.-based commerce takes place in other countries and other parts of the world.
But if I walk into a car dealer with $30,000 and purchase a 8-year-old truck for $30,000, which is so scary, I don't want to think about it. If I did that, that dude's got to write me. He's got to write me up, right? Because it's over 10. It won't take over 10, I don't think. But if I give him Bitcoin, then it's all okay.
It could be. Again, I am not expert in the law on that one.
Me neither. So or is there a law?
I would have to defer.
Well, anyway, what else was on your mind this morning? We've got guys in China. We've got, evidently, according to this thing I read, Besson's over in Japan trying to convince them not to puke out their U.S. treasuries. You've heard a lot of the people on in terms of, we had Larissa on talking about the numbers don't match up with people's economic health because, you're going to spend more than last year because the prices are higher. So no matter what you're doing, even if you cut back on some things, your total spend is probably the same or higher, maybe even going on the credit card. So if you're some, I use the word dummy on CNBC, and says, the consumer's strong, well, they're spending, but strong isn't exactly the word. It's some word. And then I'm still kind of reeling from Katie's interview on Monday, Kevin, where she's talking about the incredible overhead that hospitals or anybody charges in these research centers. And she was talking about doctors that are ordering tests that they don't need and talking about the people in the administration of the hospital, which make more than the doctors, telling doctors they can only see a patient for 10 minutes. And you have these insurance companies, which I think are driving the price of individual insurance for doctors higher than maybe it ought to be, so they all get to join. They have to join these groups at the hospital zone. This is awful.
Take it even farther. The vertical integration in that industry is obscene. So you have insurance companies that own hospitals, that own pharma pharmaceutical companies, and so on. And so, not only are they controlling what people prescribe, but they're also controlling it to their own business models rather than patient care. And that's where you really, really want to find, one of these concierge types of practices if you can. If you have access to that, it is going to be so much better for your care.
Well, I agree. As a matter of fact, I have one. But when we talk about all these subjects, and, we have Carl who's convinced that these are all felonies. And, by the way, he's right. And last week, Russell said something like, we're beyond the stage of anybody fixing it. We're almost talking about French Revolution kind of stuff here. And you see it on this trip to China. Trump isn't the first person to bring, powerful business people on a trip with them. I mean, I think they went on the ping pong.
Every single one of them.
But now the question is,
it's just a matter of which powerful business people.
Yeah. Now the question is, what are they all doing over there? Is he trying to do something regarding Taiwan or show U.S. power to a certain extent? And these guys cutting deals behind his back. I mean, this whole.
Well, I don't think they do it behind the back. I think that they're all part of the traveling party. I think there's when people get invited, there's a certain strategy that goes into the trip that everybody is expected to stay more or less on script. They're going to act in their own best interests, but if they're not willing to get on board with what Trump and the Trump administration wants to accomplish, then they're not going on the plane.
Well, I mean, I think in theory that would be correct, but
I think in practice that's correct.
Okay, it
was the same thing. If you look back, an example is with Obama. He had a lot of green energy people that would be on his junkets. And so, you know, again, that was all part of the agenda, and they would invite the people that fit the agenda that they have. Well, you know what Trump's agenda is. It is to cut trade deals with people to get access to rare earth minerals and things like that, but also to try and get more investment in production in the United States. So we'll see how that works out.
Well, I'm going to assume for a second that his agenda is one that matches up with yours and mine. But I also see these people, they don't give a crap about Trump or Obama or Biden. They see him as a two-year guy, and they're 100-year, they're never going to die, they're gods. They're a 100-year business. There's no way that constantly matches up. I mean, I go back to the Harold Janine thoughts he had about it's all business. People in business are way smarter than people in politics. You just deal with these people because you have to, and you go on your merry way, and someday the world will realize that the world should be run by Musk and Bezos and those kind of guys. And I think their agenda mentally is a lot different than his or Biden's or Obama's or Bush. I mean, it just is. I mean,
yeah, you're not looking for necessarily a match. You're looking for where there's convergence.
Right. And I think those guys would veer in a second if they felt like it. I mean, I think Musk is somewhere on the. I think he's on the somewhere on the what do you call it, the thing between what do you call it, the spectrum. I mean, I think I don't know what the story is with that guy, but you know, I don't know the man. But I just hope it all ties together some, Kevin. I really do, and it may. You know, Trump is pretty good at making deals. I just think that the carnage right now going on around the world is maybe a little bit too big for anybody to do, even him. I mean, it's just it seems like everybody has got problems everywhere with this stuff. I mean, you look what's happening here. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to the farming community. I mean, they're bleep out of luck with all this, especially with all these fertilizers going up and things like that. And I don't know if it's going to cause world hunger. I mean, I see India. God, Kevin, people are in denial. Yesterday, the India is talking about their inflation is up to 3.8%. They're admitting to. But they are somehow, I don't know how they're doing this, but they're putting a limit on the price of gasoline and so forth. So they're essentially taking it in the shorts on the gasoline or the oil. But their money supply is going up 17%.
If you're going to put a cap on gasoline, somebody's got to show up somewhere, and it's showing up in them having to create the money to cover the cost. Because if they're capping it, then the government's got to eat the difference, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and someday...
Somebody's got to pay for oil imports.
So someday that's going to pop out and be 17%, and I don't think India can handle it.
We know all about price controls. We know about wage and price controls. So, yeah, we've seen what happens.
What do you mean we? You and I remember. How many people do you think do?
Okay. Well, I was talking to you, so is applicable.
We is applicable. Okay, it's not like either one of us have a mouse in our pocket. We're talking to each other. I get that. Kevin, it brings up an interesting. I know I was still at Pullman when that happened. I might have just got there. But somehow or another, it was my job, since I was the MBA guy, to read through a lot of that stuff. It was the most complicated bunch of crap I've ever. And the bottom line is, Kevin, every time some of this happens, just like with COVID, some people made out like bandits, some people didn't. God, I remember reading through it because it was so disgusting. You would think, wouldn't you think, that it was pretty simple. Wages and prices are frozen. And even a third grader could say, okay, well, Dad's not getting a raise, but by the way, when we go to the store, the price of gas or chicken or whatever is going to be frozen. Well, no, it wasn't. If it came to you higher, you could pass it on. And so the idea that the wages got frozen easy, right? Because that was an easy one to do. Now, I don't know, if somebody worked overtime, you had to pay them, so actually his total went up, but the hourly didn't. But no, the other stuff was so complicated, gas prices went up, because all the guy had to do was say, wow, it used to be 40 cents a gallon I paid, I just had to pay 50 so I can raise it a dime. It didn't freeze anything, and it was so totally screwed up written. Matter of fact, there was a very obscene sort of joke Dean Fackler gave to my guys. I'll clean it up. My boss at Allied Van Lines was going. He was taking the 190 program, University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so on Friday, they would go, 190 program is for executives and so forth. You go on Friday 1 week, and you go on Saturday the next week. But you actually had to go to campus. Well, on Friday, of course, everybody, as soon as the class was out, the professors and all the students headed for the bar. They used to go to this place, Martini's on, where the hell was it, Chicago Avenue or something. So they're in this cab, and Walter Fackler's in the front seat, and he's the dean of the business school. And his big stogie in his mouth, and he's got three guys in the back seat. One guy goes, "Dean Fackler, what do you think of wage and price controls?" And he takes a big swig on his stogie, and he goes, "Well, boys, let me tell you. Wage and price controls did to the economy what pantyhose did to, you can figure it out."
Yeah, okay.
The guys in the backseat are saying, what did he just say? He's the dean. He goes, "It's the worst policy anybody ever came across." And you know what? When those things came out, I think the market went up three straight days. It was like a record 3 days in the market.
Wait a minute. Let's clarify. When those things came out, are you talking about wage and price controls or pantyhose?
Wage and price controls. And the market rallied because they just, this had to be something. It had to be a solution to something. How long did that last? Did it even last a year, 6 months?
Oh, I think it was a good year or so.
I don't know if it was a good year, but it lasted a year.
No, a full year. You can. Yeah. Who you got in there? You got Andrew today?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have Andrew. Check it out. Nixon wage and price controls.
But you know what? I will say that I thought was very well written out that never became law. And this, we talk about this on the show periodically, Kevin. There's really two ways to go about dealing with poorer people, right? Which I think has now become really a lot more complicated, because I think Otto Kerner, who wrote he headed the commission that wrote the Kerner report, he was talking about if we kept doing what we were doing, we were going to end up with essentially a permanent underclass. And people couldn't stand Johnson, couldn't stand the fact that he wrote that. The guy ended up being convicted of something. I mean, I'm sure there was some connection. You never know with these people. I mean, Trump using the Justice Department to go after people, he's not the first one, let's put it that way.
He's not the first one in the last 3 years. So.
Yeah, well, it's still awful when people do it. Anyway, but Otto Kerner was...
I refer you to Alinsky's rule number 4.
Yeah, well, Lyndon Johnson had just come out, with this great war on poverty. And the idea was they're going to do all these programs to help essentially poor people, disadvantaged people. And mm-hmm. The only one I think is left, Kevin, out of all those programs is Head Start. I could be wrong there, but I think I'm right. All the rest of them have long gone away to the dodo bird. And all this money was poured at everything. And the joke at the time, which wasn't really a joke, is if you divided the entire amount of money by the amount of poor people and sent them a check, you wouldn't have had any poor people. Now, of course, that's kind of trite because that maybe lasted a year. But the fact is, there's some truth to it, right? And on both sides of the aisle, as much as they argue back and forth, there's a lot of truth. If you look at the basic things both sides are looking at, there's a lot of truth on both sides. They just never seem to be able to identify that they're looking at the same thing, just coming up with different conclusions. But so fast forward to Nixon's presidency, and he says, "We're not going to do any of that. We're going to have something called a negative income tax." He just said, look, if somebody, now he didn't have, 35-year-old people from wealthy families sitting at home on computers all day long that COVID gave us. I don't know if he had that phenomenon back then. But anyway, his idea was, look, if somebody can't afford anything, we're going to send them a check for 10 grand and let them do what they want with it. And oh, by the way, if they decide to earn even a little bit, if they go out and earn $1,000, we're only cutting back on the 10 grand by like 250. So it always incented you to go out and work even a little bit. So it was actually very well thought out, if you like the idea. It was very well thought out and very well written. But it never got...
Yeah, the opposite side of that is, say you're living on welfare now, and, you know, the... there are other reasons to go get a job. But if you were to go get a job at a fast food joint or something, and you're making $12 an hour or $13 an hour, and you immediately stop getting welfare, your net, you know, your net result of going to work for all those hours is something like half of that.
Yeah.
So the incentive, especially when you consider in some places the cost of getting to and from work, you're really working for nothing. Now, the other reason to get it is because the only way to get a better job is to have a job, or the best way to get a better job is to have a job. So there is some value there to it. But in terms of economic value to it, the current setup is a disincentive to go to work.
Well, that's right. And it was two totally different, both groups sensed there was a problem. One obviously has serious moral hazard. Why am I going to pay anybody to not work? The other side is we're putting money toward poor people. By the way, half of it's stolen by the people in the middle. We don't want that to happen either. So both sides, both of them are laced with problems, but they're two different ways. But at least both sides recognize the same problem, which I thought was kind of a start. I'm not even sure we see that now, but both sides realize that there is a problem. I would rather go.
The other problem that we have right now is that so many of the the good work we try to do, the idea that we're funding important work goes to NGOs, and so little of that goes to help where it's supposed to go. I was, Gavin Newsom's wife runs one, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Well, she's got like over $3 million that has found its way to her. So whether it's her direct pay as the CEO of it or services rendered to the NGO from her personal, for-profit business, either way, she's making a hell of a lot of money off of this. Well, there's those stories, I read those stories more than once a week about that. And so we are stuck in a system that has grown over time, that has become the norm, and it is so damned inefficient. It's such an inefficient use that we aren't helping the people that we intend to help. And everybody in Congress is going to, sound very high and mighty about how important it is that we fund these activities. And then it's just getting wasted. And, it used to be that we relied on government to directly waste our money. Now we just rely on government to give the money to people who waste it. You talked earlier about healthcare. We are sort of at the point where I don't know how you make it go away other than revolution. So,
well, I mean, you really don't have to go very far to look at it. I mean, you open, I think, I try and listen to all you guys, and I am stunned, Kevin, how much, supposedly a well-educated, pretty bright guy, me, how much I've learned just in the past year from the people I talk to and from the people on the show. But I know I was on I wasn't on this committee, but one of my well-connected African-American friends is on there's a committee that's going to look about expanding the, real quick, there's a bunch of rail lines in Chicago, commuter rail lines. Well, there's not, the furthest one east is the Illinois Central, the electric one. Well, there's a bunch of cities that are east of that, like a Dyer, not Dyer, but South Howell, those kind of places that don't
Madison,
have
places like that.
Yeah. So anyway, the idea was they were putting a rail line in those areas. So of course, this guy knows nothing about rails. He goes, "Hey, chief, how about if I buy a drink and you tell me what I should be looking at on this committee, because he's on the board." And I'm telling him, you got to see is there trackage? Because there's trackage all over the place. Is there trackage they can use? Are there places that are obvious stations? Most of the trains don't need a station to start. If you want to get rolling, you can just run a couple trains. They all, they all have steps down to the ground. You don't need a station to start to see if people are going to hop on the train and it's going to work out for these people. You can have 2-3 trains a day just to get them an idea. And, we start going through this whole route, and he goes, "Wait a minute, nobody's interested in that." "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, one guy on the board has the inside track on building like the Dalton Station." if there's not going to be a station, he doesn't want to be there. And if he doesn't get it, I mean, I'm going to say this Bear Stadium, all the bullshit back and forth, back and forth. I'm going to say, Kevin, that it's already determined who's going to get the beer stands, who's going to run the security, and those guys are pushing us. It has nothing to do with the fans. This has all been determined, and if you and I were to be dumb enough to call up Pritzker or Trump or whoever the hell it is and say, hey, I hear you're building a new stadium, I'd like to bid on the cleaning the bathroom contract. Click. who the hell are you? There's no way you and I bid on that. That's where the money is. Who's going to construct it? I mean, is it going to be Walsh? Who's going to do it? Who's going to design it? Is it the people out of Kansas City? Are they already paying people here to do? They want to be the designers. I mean, all this. It is all the way down the chain. There's no such thing as a, you know, here's the specs for cleaning the bathrooms, and we're going out to a bid where anybody could show up. I'm not talking about, you know, two people who've never been in the business. But I'm talking about, could we get a performance bond? Is there any kind of a real auction for this? Hell no.
Well, there very well may be too, but you know a lot of rigging goes into by what specifications you give it. So you can give it specifications that only your favorite company can meet.
That's what IBM did forever. I mean, before they were in the service business, they would make sure that those specs got written up that you had to use an IBM mainframe. Okay, yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, but this is kind of impervious. It's all the way down the line, and the matter of fact, you know. I'll say former mayors of Chicago that knew what they were doing. You don't need any corruption, Kevin, because if you do it right, your money is all in all the other people's pockets.
Yeah, it's there's legal corruption, there's illegal corruption.
Well, I mean,
I'm gonna have to turn you over. I have to head inside and brace myself for waves of seventh graders. So I'm gonna turn you over to our economics.
Why don't you buy one of the RVs and we can all go to the game and be in our RV lot and we can all party?
You think I'm going to buy an RV from the RV Hall of Fame?
Well, I'm sure somebody in there will tell you where you can get one today.
Well, God, I'm sitting in Elkhart County. Of course I know where I can buy them. This is like the RV manufacturing capital of the world.
Just look, see the nicest one.
So, no, that's not hard to find around here.
Go to the nicest one, see on the bottom, this is built by Russell and Larissa Manufacturing, and head over there and buy one.
I would surely do that if it were true and available, but it's not, so I'm just going to have to... instead, just hand off to Russell and Larissa and call it a day here.
There you go. Russell, Larissa, you guys here?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You know what I'm hearing from my friends south of the Mason-Dixon line? There are five SEC schools that don't have enough cash to pay their football players.
Oh, God, I hate it when that happens.
I know, but there are. I'm hearing from a buddy down in Tennessee that some of the mid-tier SEC schools their donors don't want to pay for a 7-5 season again.
What, Larissa? I hear you. You're here. Welcome.
I'm here. Thank you. Good morning.
Boy, Russell got me into this quick. In the NCAA basketball, the number that was tossed about by the more critical color commentators, where you needed $10 million.
Yep, to be that's in what the... Memphis needs this year. That's what Memphis's budget is for the team this year.
So,
and
where's football?
They're not even predicted. They're not even predicted. That's for the basketball team.
Yeah,
and they're not even predicted with what they got in the portal to be in the NCAA tournament for $10 million.
What's the number for football? It's got to be way over that.
Well, for their football team, probably not much more because it's a basketball school. But, you know, 20-30 at some of the SEC schools, and they probably promised a lot of money to players, but they hadn't gotten it from their donors yet. And you had to see this coming because, you know, Mark Cuban didn't give anything to the IU football team until, it was time to bandwagon. So, if you're like a big donor and the schools I've heard are Arkansas and Missouri and Vanderbilt because they overpaid for a midget quarterback, you know, that those schools, they just, they're going back to the till, and the donors are like, we can't do this every year. And I think we've talked about that on here, how we kind of saw that coming.
Larissa, isn't the proper term a vertically challenged quarterback?
I have no idea.
Instead of midget?
Oh, I see.
All right, so she didn't get the, Tavia is definitely vertically challenged.
Well, if you see a fat guy, he's not fat, he's spatially challenged, right?
I've got my own orbit these days.
God. Okay, Larissa, you gotta know.
Keep creating a gravitational field, hanging out in Indiana and just laying on the couch next to the lake.
You know what? It's not a bad deal. I'm dying to get you guys on this week. First of all, did that college hack affect either of you?
The what?
The hack and Kevin was just talking about it.
Oh yeah, it did. Yeah. Yes, it ruined my weekend.
Did you have to run out and buy a bunch of blue books or something?
No. I taught two in-person classes, and those classes, when it was going on, I was given a final on paper. Thank goodness. But I have two online classes that end this week. When I teach for Indianapolis and when I teach for Bloomington, the schedules are different. And those classes, people were having trouble accessing all kinds of stuff. What I did was I emailed out all the material and I uploaded my lecture videos to a YouTube channel and did that.
Okay.
How's that for? How's that for a solution on that? So, and I got, but the big problem with that for a lot of professors is we keep all of our materials and all of our grades on that system. So we can't, I couldn't see my students' grades, and I, you know, had to recreate some materials that were living on that site.
Is it all okay now?
One of my students last night, I brought it up because I said, if it happens again, I gave him a contingency plan around the end of the quarter. And one guy said, well, apparently they worked it out, and they worked it out with whoever the bad guys were. And we'll see. That's totally secondhand again from a student.
Wow.
It was tough.
When they worked it out, Russell, did they give in to the ransom? I heard something about a ransom.
I think they did.
I don't know if they gave in to the ransom or not. Did they?
I think they did. Whoever they are. I don't know if the company did or the university did. Somebody did, I think, what I heard.
Larissa, being at Purdue, you've got to have access to students that could figure something like this out.
You would hope.
Yeah, you would think in the engineering school there that we got, that you've got some people. So we'll talk offline about this in a little while.
Well, I just asked Kevin. Now, you know more about this than either one of us, Russell, I think. If you get paid in crypto, it has to pop out someplace, right? What if it doesn't? You mentioned, God, years ago, that didn't Burger King or somebody say they were going to take Bitcoin, and I don't know if they ever did. What if I just, if somebody lobs me five Bitcoins, what if I just leave it there and over the next 30 years buy Whoppers or something and it never pops out anywhere? Can I get caught?
I don't know what you mean by, like, if you don't make good on payments?
No, if somebody lobs me three Bitcoins and I go somewhere and demand, I go to a bank and I want my 300 grand or 240 in my checking account, I mean, that's an obvious issue of some kind. But what if I went to, I just asked Kevin this, what if I went to Amsterdam and bought diamonds and the guy handed me the diamonds, I put them in my pocket. Now who's going to find me?
Nobody.
And is the diamond guy now in trouble?
I don't know if the diamond guy's in trouble.
Well, he just took 240 grand worth of cash without something.
But did you give him Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Okay, well, then you paid him.
I know, but now when he goes to the bank to try and get the cash, is he in trouble? Where'd you get it? From some guy I gave diamonds to. Well,
it depends on the jurisdiction.
Okay.
There's some places, I mean, if you know, you can pay taxes on your crypto trading gains in the U.S. You don't necessarily, there are other countries where you don't pay any taxes whatsoever when you do anything in crypto. It really depends.
Larissa,
I like that money laundering idea.
Well, yeah, are just questions. Hopefully our law enforcement people are kind of on this, but, you know, you never know. Larissa, your name was bandied about all week for a lot of reasons. One is, last time you were on, you were talking about how the gross numbers, like that somebody like you or me or anybody could actually be spending more than last year because of the inflation, but we're cutting back on things maybe we like because we have to buy other stuff we don't, you know, we need, and your economic health is not as good as you would like it to be, and actually probably worse. Yet from the gross number standpoint, this Larissa is a healthy consumer. She's spending more than last year. And how there can be a huge, you know, I think you remember saying that very articulately, by the way, there can be a huge slide there with somebody coming on CNBC and saying, man, consumer's doing fine. Now, we had these inflation numbers of yesterday, which is now 3 months in a row, that they're pretty hot. You know, it was a 1% and 0.9 and a 0.6. And, you know, we still have goofballs talking about how, don't worry about it, we were including the year-ago numbers in there. And then I went and did some digging into India because they came out with their inflation being 3.8% over year-over-year, and yet their money supply has grown by 17%. And I'm going, one of these days, that's going to squeeze out. And then young Katie was on Monday talking about the areas of hospital stuff and how, you know, they're forcing people to only see patients for 10 minutes, and other areas you have to subscribe a certain amount of tests, even if people don't need them. Everything you were talking about just seemed to kind of start coming together from like 8 different directions. And I said, God, Larissa talked all about this last week, and I don't think you know how clairvoyant you are on this.
That's funny. Well, I'm also a mom working through the system with kids who need medical attention. And it's surprising what you have to learn as a parent and as you're pressing through what you need to do for your kids.
Well, one of the dudes in the building here is an engineer, and he just had a little health issue. He came out fine, which is great because he's a really good friend. If I had to make a stab, I'd say the building pays him 45, 40, maybe. Well, his deductible is 10 G for the weekend. After tax.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, where is that going to come from? I mean, the guy does work on the side and so forth, because I think maybe he's got it, but that's a lot.
It's a lot.
I mean, how can anybody, you know, the inflation stuff, I don't know if I mentioned to you guys, if you look at the inflation over the last 5 years, and you look at the Obamacare, the median income, I think, was probably $38,000-$40,000 when all the COVID and all this crap started. Let's say that the median income is now $52,000. Well, you look at the Obamacare, once you make $50,000, you don't get any help, right? That jump now puts you into a spot where you don't get help on your insurance, correct? I mean, I think it's right around in there. So you actually are in way worse shape than you were 5 years ago making 40 than you are now making 50 if you're buying your own insurance. These little things that you don't realize you bring out, Larissa, they stay in my brain. How about moving this up even a little bit? It doesn't move evenly, does it?
It does not. And again, as somebody who's very conscientious of the bills that are coming out of my paycheck, it can be substantially difficult. I think I told you last year I paid for my kids' medical bills. This was for the calendar year of 2025, $13,000 out of pocket.
Wow.
It's a substantial amount of money, and those are post-tax dollars. And it's just a lot of money. And as you can see it coming out, and, you know, we've talked many times on this show that there are certain bills that you just can't ignore. For example, if your transmission goes out in your car, you don't have a car to drive, so you have to take care of it. Your children's health is just one of those things that you can't ignore. So these are things that you pay for. And I was very fortunate that, while uncomfortable, and it definitely meant that Burberry no longer invited me to their Christmas party, I had to tend to it, and I was able to cover it. And again, it was uncomfortable, and there were sacrifices other places to make it ends meet, but it got done.
Why this is not a, I'm not going to make this a personal question, but the thing that kind of is weird about this, and, you know, Russell knows the whole history of this, the idea that medical stuff is tax deductible for a company and not for a person.
Right.
After all these years, why don't, you know, for instance, I know a buddy of mine, he always finds me and tells me about, you know, how much of your basket, you know, we always talk about the medical part of your basket they claim is 6.5%. Well, clearly last year, if you're paying $13,000, I hope you're making 20 times that or more, but maybe you're not. I mean, it's probably more than 6% of your basket last year, but this guy is on Social Security. So he pays the person, what you, it takes, comes out of your Social Security, the Part B, let's say that's $100 and some a month, okay? His supplemental is pushing 400 now, so he's up to 520. His prescription drug piece is another $60 a month, so he's up to $600, okay? And he's got on a couple of medications that are at least $150 or $200 a month, so he's up to 800. And he has a concierge doctor, which is $200 a month, so he's up to like almost $1,000 a month, and his Social Security is $2,800. So where exactly? But my question is, why don't I? Actually, I probably could use Stocks and Jocks, but I don't. Why doesn't Larissa or Russell have an LLC somewhere that you're consulting and everything you get paid for in there, so when you have to write this check, it now becomes tax deductible? Why doesn't everybody do that who could? And at least cut the tax piece out where you're paying your medical expenses and pre-tax money instead of after tax. Why isn't that just a way to get, and I won't say get around, but, you know, why don't people deal with it that way? I mean, I know a lot of people can't. I mean, I probably could, because I just make my money from PTI, but what if you could? Why wouldn't you?
I don't know. I don't have a good answer for why somebody doesn't do that.
I mean, I would think that probably millions of people could. The person I'm talking about, he does side jobs. It should be, you know, Joe's Side Job, Inc. And whenever he gets paid for a side job, he should just pay all his medical stuff out of there, right?
He should. Especially because the taxes for any side job are substantial.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite a bit more than you're going to pay for regular salary.
Yeah, because, well, you got to pay 15% right out of the gate, right?
Well, I think consulting work, you pay a substantially higher percent than 15%.
I'm talking about your just your payroll taxes.
Yeah, your payroll.
Because you got to pay both sides of the Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so what's on your mind? I'm talking too much. We see all kinds of stuff going on. We had our inflation numbers. We have the PPI coming out today, which has been real hot the last few months. What did you think of the CPI? What do you think of the money supply numbers? What's going on here? I mean, we've got people going to China. We've got all kinds of stuff. I also wanted to bring up, I don't know, I sent you guys, I'm sure you didn't watch that video I sent because it's kind of long-winded, but there's this lady economist now is doing these things, and where she's getting the numbers, I have no idea, but I can't find, other than last month, what all the different countries own in U.S. Treasuries, and somehow her group knew what Japan did last week on Treasuries, so there must be some place to find it that I can't find it, and she's talking about Japan's response to the oil situation, where they're getting nailed twice, once on the price of oil, and the other is that the yen is going down. That the Bank of Japan spent almost $55 billion last week protecting the yen. And they had to go cash in like $9 billion in U.S. treasuries as part of the money. And she's claiming that this keeps going, and all of a sudden these places are now cashing in treasuries instead of investing more here. It's a real problem for us because 40-some percent of our debt is financed by other places. What do you even do with information like that? I mean, you can't trade on it, but it's also, it makes you kind of nervous. What do you do with it? I hope you didn't hear it or what?
Russell, what do you think?
Russell? Well, with respect to the foreign ownership of our debt, if we're going to see a global recession, which it kind of feels like we are, you've got to figure that they're going to continue to monetize our debt to pay their own bills. However, as that's gone along, China has reduced their exposure to U.S. treasuries by a ridiculous amount. And I think they've replaced it with gold, and that's why we've had such high gold prices. But they've been able to do that without, jerking our interest rates, up tremendously, or there being so little demand for our bonds that we have a terrible auction. We had a pretty weak auction a couple of days ago. The thinking would be, if that trend's going to continue, eventually you're going to have some sort of capitulation and higher interest rates, and bonds are going to come under a lot of pressure, and that would bleed through to everything else. So,
well, the 30-year rate went through 5 yesterday. It's 5.02.
Yeah, it did. And it continues to creep up or stay at the high end of a range. Every once in a while it dips back down, but we seem to spend more time at the high end than the low end these days. Russell, and that bleeds through to everything, you know?
You mentioned the China.
It totally bleeds through to everything.
You mentioned the China phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's almost all been made up for.
Here's another thing with respect to China, is there's like this $1 or 2 trillion that is completely unaccounted for, like money that flowed from us to them. They used some of it to invest with us. They used some of it for their own infrastructure, and then nobody's really sure where the rest of it's gone.
Now, when you say us, government or individual investors, or pension funds or whatever, who's us?
What do you mean? I said, that money has disappeared from China.
Right. What I'm saying is, when you're saying dollars went there,
we bought a bunch of stuff from them. Money goes over there.
Okay, but
they use some of it to buy our treasuries, but there's a good $1 trillion to $2 trillion over the last few years that it just doesn't balance out. What China says they're selling and what they have in savings and assets, there's a huge disconnect there. So somebody's either been stealing the money, they've been pissing it away on stupid projects like, rails to Iran, so maybe they can get oil that way. Who knows? But money's already being wasted all over the place. Now they're going to have to sell our treasuries, but they did sell our treasuries because they're in financial trouble. It didn't bleed through to us, so I'm not sure if there's any way that that you can really trade on it, or there's anything actionable to do around that.
Well, when you say we, are we talking CalPERS? Are we talking BlackRock?
Investors.
Okay, so not the U.S.
No,
Treasury.
Just investors.
Okay, fair enough. Well, you've been talking about how many people.
You asked if there was something tradable to do there. That's why I was answering it that way. So,
but the dollar denominated debt, you and I talked about that years ago. Somehow nobody talks about it. I mean, Larissa knows this, but didn't China try to cut back on foreign investments a while ago? And to get around it, the people doing the developments over there, you weren't forced to take your dollars into their currency to invest. You just invested directly with dollars or pounds or yen, right? So those things are kind of off book, and to a certain extent. And you and I always said these are going to be a big problem. And then they sort of never were. I mean, I guess they're not. I mean, CalPERS just absorb it, or BlackRock, and because the market's up,
Two of the people that are going over there are BlackRock and Blackstone, and I am convinced that they are trying to get some of their money out of that country.
Well, maybe,
that's the
yeah.
The only reason that you would go over there is we want... And if you've got, you know, deposits in another country, you can... you know, you can still count them as assets on your balance sheet, even if you don't have decent access to them.
Well, I think the...
But I do think... I got interviewed by Business Insider about the China trip and why are all the CEOs going. And I think a lot of them are going because they've got money stuck over there. Citibank ain't going over there to expand business. You know, China's in trouble.
By the way, that's probably the most intelligent comment on it. I've asked everybody, that's probably one of the more unique and one of probably the best ones out there.
They're going over there. Everybody's money got stuck over there. Larissa and I have a common friend who's an option educator that did classes over there for years. And only once was he able to really get the money out. And he said, I really need to be paid now, when he was in China. And they brought him a shoebox with cash in it.
Well,
because they didn't want to show that they had allowed some money to leave the country.
That's interesting.
It's never a fun way to collect your money, right? Nobody wants the shoebox of cash, because then you have to explain it on your side.
Well, or you just...
Yeah.
You
duct tape it to yourself.
Or you could just, you know, you the way your gas prices are, you just buy your gas every week for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a question. I'm going to find a thing here I don't really need to, because I sort of remember it. I think you're absolutely right, Russell. I mean, exactly right, that China has cut back. It's in the 20 to 25% range in the last couple of years, right? And their investments here in treasuries. When I say investments here, treasuries. It's been made up for largely by Japan and the UK. And Japan.
I've noticed that.
And those are the countries that maybe are having, Japan probably more than UK, are having problems with these oil numbers. So, I mean, there's going to be some danger there if this doesn't resolve itself pretty quick, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. But just with respect to the China thing, I think the whole trip is a giant nothing burger.
Well, I hope they do
How's
something.
That?
I hope they do something. Well, allegedly, Besson's over in Japan.
Even if they're announcements, it's a nothing burger. Because the last trade deal in 2020, China did not do anything they agreed to do at all.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
They didn't hold up anything with the, like, they had promised to buy $200 billion in agricultural products from us. They didn't do any of it. The whole thing is, you might get some pleasant announcements or stuff, but don't change your thesis at all on what happens over there. Because she needs a win, and I think Trump's given him a little bit of a win, because there's a lot of upset folks in China right now. But I think I almost feel like he's bringing some of the CEOs along as a makeup for canceling the trip last month. All right, I'll make it a little bit better for you.
Well, he also wants a buffer, maybe. But hey, after break, Larissa, one of our listeners sent me this YouTube thing, and there's a guy on there, and I didn't burden you guys with it because it was a half hour to listen to. But the guy traced everything that comes out of the Strait of Hormuz, and he goes, everybody's talking about oil. And he talked about that for like 5 minutes. Then he dropped down to like all the other products that come through there. Has to do with helium. You know, you're not going to be able to get an MRI if there's no helium. He's talking about the potash and all the different stuff their fertilizer is made of. And I wonder at Purdue, if because you guys are into, you're not only engineering, you do a lot of the agriculture stuff. He was going through a whole routine about how a lot of these are agricultural fertilizers and things. And not only can't they get them out of there, but the other stuff, you can't get it through the Panama Canal because they're getting outbid for slots in the Panama Canal by stuff that's more valuable, and how it's really, he had to be going through 10 products, but I didn't know any of them. You know, I knew that they existed, but it was pretty interesting. It was boring as hell, but it was pretty interesting about all the stuff that we haven't even talked about yet. And I was wondering if you're hearing anything like that, you know, at Purdue. Let's talk about that after the break. SP Futures up 11, NASDAQ Futures 185. We're bouncing back here. NVIDIA's up 5 hours. It was so it's back up to 225. Micron, it's got to be up $80 from the low yesterday. That's a number. At $1.1 billion outstanding. So it's crazy stuff, but it's up there. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right
now, right now. Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. We're going to have PPI numbers here in a second. SP Futures, they just dropped, so this PPI number must be lousy. I'll get it here in a second. We're down 4. We were just up. NASDAQ is only up 120 now. It was up over 200. Final demand for April, wow, 1.4% in April. Services up 1.2%. Goods increased 2%. I'm sorry, 1.2 on the services, goods 2%. I have to believe this is a horrendous number, and it's like 3 or 4 in a row. We'll get Larissa's take on that in a second. In the meantime, these other countries haven't had a chance to react to this, so we'll be quick here. The DAX was up 199.8%. It's probably down a little bit from there. FTSE up 11.1%. CAC around down 21.3%, so a mixed bag over there. Asia, now they can't move because they're closed. DAX up 199.8%. Wait a minute. I'm supposed to be in Asia. Nikkei up 529.8%. Hang Seng up 40.1%. Shanghai up 28.7%. So they... Asian markets are kind of celebrating this meeting, at least so far. Bonds is what we're watching. 10 years up another 2 basis points today, 4.49. That gets to 4.5, which I think it's going to. Mortgage rates will go up even higher. So anyway, that's where that is. Oil down 4 cents, but still over 100, 102.14. RBOB down a penny, but still 368. In Indiana, I guess they got rid of the sales tax. Here they didn't, but you got to add almost a buck to that here, maybe a buck 20. To get what you're going to pay at the pump, and it's about where it is, $4.90. Indiana, I think it's probably a little less than that because they got rid of the sales tax for a while. Gold up $8, $46.94. Silver up $1.50, $87.15. Foreign exchange, the dollar's been weak, but now it's at a 1 week high, but still the euro is over 117. British pound has ducked under 135, over 134.9. Probably more important is the Japanese yen has actually strengthened a little bit with their government pouring money in. Evidently 160, and we'll get Russell's opinion on this, 160 end of the dollar is kind of their panic point, and it's at 158, so it's a little below that. Crypto down 713, 80,056. Yeah, too much stuff. Andrew, what do you got? Quick traffic, weather, sports. Cubs lose.
Yes, they do. It is 7:33 here in Chicago. The Cubs lost to the Braves 2-5, while the Sox did win over the Royals 6-5, and the Diamondbacks lost as well to the Rangers 4-7. Over Chicago, weather is currently 55 degrees. We're going to have a high of 55 today. It's not going to get any warmer. We're going to be partly cloudy with a little more clouds in the afternoon. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 77 degrees. They're going to have a high of 100 degrees, and they're going to be partially cloudy all throughout the day as well. And for Chicago traffic, things are looking not too great today. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 24 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Coast is going to take you 41. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 43 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 26 minutes. And the inbound Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 39 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you.
All right, guys. We got PPI. We've got China. We've got all kinds of stuff. Where do you want to start? Larissa, what question would you want to answer first? What about this PPI number?
You know, I really don't have a thought yet on the PTI number.
It's 1.4% is a big rise, right? Obviously, mm-hmm. You know, multiply that by 12, we're talking pushing 15 in a year, right? That's a lot.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, that's a lot. And some of the PPI doesn't make it all the way through. I'm kind of concerned. I mean, we can talk all we want about oil, but the service number has been stubborn even when the goods number has not been over the last year. I don't know what to make of that. I mean, it's...
I know what to make of that.
Well, hopefully professors
are... We're losing our service employees.
Yeah, well, that's probably true, but...
But I feel like I'm dancing around that one.
Yeah.
When somebody's here and they're working... and they're working, you know, kind of under the radar, they're most likely in the service industry. So the ICE, I never even thought about ICE being inflationary.
That's interesting.
Those guys, they're the worst. I could see that service holding up. Because I was at an investment conference yesterday, and they talked about how the employment situation, you know, is a percent that because we are losing, a certain number of workers, that the employment rate is going to stay kind of steady even if employment is dropping.
Well, we did the
and that kind of relates to what we're talking about right now, because if you've got fewer. You got fewer people willing to do service type stuff, or available to do service type stuff. The prices aren't going to come down, but all of those people got to pay their own bills as well.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we talked about another one of these people. I don't know why I listen to everybody, because I obviously listen to the smart people on the show, guys like you. But the guy was talking about the price of food, and whenever. This happens. I hope that Larissa's listening, because she would be more interested than anybody else. He's saying not only is the price of diesel going up, it's the price of fertilizers going up, but the price of getting people here, either can't get them or you got to pay more for people to pick the stuff. He had essentially four shots that were heading toward certainly the produce aisle, and he's right on all of them. I mean, we're really double and triple and quadrupling up on the food part, and I don't get the deal. I mean, we see how many bridges they're trying to fix here in Chicago, and there's nobody working. I mean, how many people that normally would be there did they export? I mean, the idea that somehow you're going to get rid of a lot of people that do this sort of work, and all of a sudden everybody's going to pile out of the basement of the parents' home. And go get a job in construction instead of hanging on their computer all day. I don't see that happening. Do you? There's some kind of a disconnect between people that actually work and people.
They're
that
not even capable. They're not even capable of it.
Yeah.
I couldn't work it.
You know, I'm.
Go on.
I couldn't work in construction. I mean, I can. You know, I can fix things around the house and stuff, but I don't have those qualifications.
And I think part of
I can drive the Uber.
I think part of the reason why there's such a disconnect is our culture. Our culture has placed such an emphasis on going to college, and going to college isn't appropriate for everybody. And our culture has elevated this degree while simultaneously downgraded professional trades. So, for example, a construction worker may actually outpace several people, quite a few people, who have degrees, and yet outpace in the terms of earning potential. I joke that I often think that plumbers make more than I do, and yet we have this culture that really looks down upon some of the service industry. And as a result, we don't have enough people in the industry. And I don't think there's enough attention to the fact that you could make a very good living in some of those fields, and you could probably outpace or out-earn lots of people with degrees or even advanced degrees. And I think that's something that's not discussed and not emphasized or looked upon or in high school, whereas this idea that everybody should be going to college, and then this is, if you go to college, and let's say you're not really academically qualified to go to college, so you squeak by, you go to a lesser school or a private school, you amass mountains of debt, and then you end up with a job and you can barely make ends meet, versus if you had gone to a trade school and then you could be potentially making six figures when you're like 20, 21, because you don't, and then on top of it, you don't even have this pile of debt. So, I think it's a cultural problem as opposed, and as well as an economic problem, but I think the economic problem really stems from the fact that culturally we overvalue an education and discredit people who don't have an education.
You don't know how right you are. Audrey, you know, punts a lot of people in houses, and mostly lately, I mentioned to you guys, it's people who have a home, you know, bought it 20 years ago for whatever, and they're all just trading places. You know, the older people want someplace in a ranch style, no steps. And so, personally, I'm going to say out of our last 10, you know, where she should say this, not me, but I'm thinking out of our last 10 deals, I know it does a lot, because she's good at it. I bet 8 of them were cash. And she will mention to you that if she gets a younger couple, you know, maybe somebody's expecting first child and they're 30 years old, the group that can compete is, you know, the guy may have gone to school or not, but maybe he went to community college. He's a carpenter or a plumber. He's made money all along. He doesn't have any debt. And maybe she's a nurse. I mean, I'm being typecasting here, but those people got dough when they're 30. I mean, they're doing fine. But I'm a little older than you guys. There's a reason why people think that, Larissa. If you grew up on the South Side in Chicago, there were all kinds of places that did, I use the term real work. And you know, it's not, there was Pullman. They probably employed, you know, a couple thousand people. There was a bunch of different steel companies, Ryerson Steel. There were guys that make the girders for the Hancock Building, those kinds of things. And they were real jobs and people made money. But almost every single one of them, the steel people all got screwed on their pension. Pullman one day had three generations of people working there. They were gone. So anybody who was a dad who would be 85 or 90 now absolutely wanted his kids no part of that. It wasn't because you got your hands dirty. It wasn't those kinds of reasons. Is you can't count on these companies for a career. There's no way that somebody was a welder at Pullman, got laid off at 50. What does he do? So nobody wanted that. And now you look at, if I drove you around the South Side, you know, assuming we would be safe, I could point out factories that are just empty lots and say, Ream was here, Continental Can was here. They're all gone. So it wasn't like, you know, one guy's got a white shirt on, one guy's got a blue shirt on. There was much more to it. Those companies all left and just left people high and dry. So the perception of that kind of a job was you can't base a family on you being a welder. They're going to be gone in 2 years. They all are. So, I mean, there's some history to it other than just getting dirty, if that's a fair statement.
I completely agree with it. And I also believe that with your generation, there is this idea that we're looking for the American dream here. So it's again, it's a cultural movement, right? And it's this idea that we want better things for our child. We want them to be insulated. We want them to be protected. There have been many instances where you've seen people struggle because they don't have the degree. But that's, again, I feel like things have changed. And culturally, we haven't caught up to those changes.
I agree. But from my own personal stuff, and I'll give a kudos out to you people that teach kids. I mean, I could have taken another road and gone right to the trading floor, never gone to grad school or anything, and been you know, fat and happy for a while, and all of a sudden at age, you know, 40, there'd have been no trading floor, or 45, now what do I do? But fortunately, because of my education from people like you guys, I was able to reinvent myself 2-3 times because I had a background in other stuff. But if you don't, if all you've ever been, not all you've ever been, because it's a real tough job, if you've been a welder and all of a sudden there's no welding jobs, what exactly do you do? I mean, that's what a lot of parents, they wanted their kids to be somewhere to where they were going to have a job for as long as they wanted to work. You're seeing now with a lot of people in the IT departments that 5 years ago, if you were going to be a job where you could say, I'm going to be doing this when I'm 75 and still working, it would have been IT. How many people did the options exchange just lay off in IT last week, Russell? Now, all of a sudden, that's not a lifetime job either.
A lot.
Yeah, so all of a sudden, that's not a lifetime job either. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how you pick one, but you know, I guess if you were
I don't think you get job security either way these days.
No.
You know, I don't know of anybody, you know, that has not, and I, you know, I include myself, that hasn't been let go at one job at one point, either blue collar or white collar. You know, and typically not because of not of any fault of your own, just because you know, whatever the firm was doing, they're scaling back on or going out of business.
Yeah.
I've had a couple of instances just in the last 5 years of where I was working with consulting firms that decided to just stop doing what they were doing.
I got a quick one for you guys. There's a guy who he was head of our cost accounting group at Pullman, and I learned a lot from him. Stan Bartnizak, talk about a name, huh? Stan was the nicest guy. So he's interviewing this dude one day. And the guy goes, well, you know, I was at this company and I got RIFT, you know, reduction in force. I was at this company and they were downsized. Stan looked at him and he goes, buddy, you got shit canned. He goes, you know, it happens to all of us. I'm not holding against you. I'm going to offer you the job. Just say it. You got shit canned. We all have. Don't worry about it. You got come here and do a nice job and you're starting fresh. He told the guy, he says, don't worry about it. It happens to all of us. Duh. He goes, just come here and do a good job, and I'm never going to say it. Who cares what happened before? Interesting view on life, wasn't it? But, God, does anybody even know what cost accounting is anymore? I mean, wow. How does this, we've got the debt going this way.
I'd like to jump in on the cost accounting. Accounting is an interesting field. Accountants are being recruited now their freshman year in college. There is such a demand for accountants. It's an interesting field, but students don't want to go into accounting. So most universities I've worked with, we run into this weird instance where we don't have enough students to fill the demand. And one of the reasons why students don't want to go into it, the accounting salaries have not kept up with inflation, kept up with finance, kept up with other parts in the business world. And as a result, students are not interested in going into this. So getting to your question, do people really understand cost accounting anymore? I'm going to make the argument that there's a lot less of them that are really understanding what's happening.
I found that way more fascinating than financial accounting.
Sure.
Yeah, we at Kelly's Indianapolis campus, we have a deal where you can do your last year working full time for a firm, and you mix some school in there, but almost anybody that's doing that is an accounting major. And that's because the firm, there's just a shortage of accounting talent. One of the best students I've ever had got married a few weekends ago, and she had interned with the same firm in accounting for starting with her sophomore year. They begged her to go work for them, and she ended up working somewhere else. But she had like multiple offers coming out of Kelly, Indianapolis. And I do think the accounting thing, it's kind of like a blue-collar part of a white-collar job, you know, whereas finance has a little bit more creativity to it. On the other side of that, I saw a list of, like, the best majors for return on investment. You know, a lot of engineering, computer science was in there. Finance and economics was in there. Marketing management and accounting were not in there.
Wow.
The business, the econ and finance were the two business ones that had a very good. That's not saying that you don't have a positive return on investment. It's just not as good as majoring in finance. And, you know, I think the financial world has been so romanticized. You have all these kids wanting to go into it, you know, right. And then they realize that it's not, you know, it's not Wolf of Wall Street stuff. And accountants do almost the exact same, a lot of the same things, and have better job stability, but don't necessarily get paid as much.
Well, you teach grad school, and I was a grad student, and obviously, the risk of being a PhD was more than that. At some point, doesn't the bell go off in your head and say it's all the same subject, advanced accounting, advanced finance, advanced marketing, and you need them all, right? To be a well-rounded exec, you can't not have a couple of them.
You have to have an understanding of it. I teach a one-day class for Kelly that's CEOs and chief operating officers, just everything they need to know accounting and finance-wise, kind of like as a refresher, so they know how to ask the right questions.
Well, how do you... one thing nice about... Well, there was a few things. One thing nice about Notre Dame is no matter what school you were in, you had your stuff that you had to take, but you could take anything you wanted. In other words, you can't... I think it was hard for a while to get into the agriculture school at Illinois and all of a sudden try and take accounting courses because they were kind of filled up. But I was in economics, and I took a year of accounting where you actually had the workbook. You know, it was debits to the window, credits to the door, and you had to work through all these problems by hand. And I don't know that there's ever any replacement for that. I mean, when I got to the University of Chicago and you took an accounting class there and everybody was just starting out, it was all in a book, I was light years ahead of everybody just because, wait a minute, this has got to go two places. Where does it go? And I remember where I put it in the workbook. How do you ever replace that? I mean, it's very obvious every time you do something, even today, I'll remember, wait a minute, what side does that one go? How do you not teach people the basics and expect them to remember the stuff? I'm not saying we should go back to workbooks, but actually it did work, didn't it?
Yeah. So I was an accountant for a short period of time, and we had the electronic ledger, but we also had, and granted this was over 20 years ago, but we had the physical ledger. And we would have to balance both of those. Those had to be in balance. But it was interesting balancing the books at the end of the month, and particularly with cost accounting, making sure all of the accounts were in the correct spots, particularly when you're thinking about work in progress, finished goods, and raw materials. Those were just challenging, making sure that all of the cash flows were in the right spot, because those were the accounts that actually moved throughout the month. So there's a lot of other accounts that were pretty easy to reconcile at the end of the month, but these are the ones that became much more challenging, because I personally at the time would go through line by line to make sure that each of these accounts or each transaction was placed in the correct spot. And again, if it was, because we were creating, at the time they were medical products, let's say a product started off as raw materials, they were raw materials from the prior month, now they've become work in progress, and then the next month they are now a finished good, you had to be able to map where that product was and making sure that it was in the correct account, even if you're looking at it being in these sub-accounts within the assets. So I personally went through all of those lines. I know that there are systems or electronic systems that do quite a bit of that for you, but I think when you're not looking at it directly, you lose some of it, if that makes sense.
I would agree. I don't know if you guys had a chance. I sent out a, just because of the shows the last week or so have been really so good in me learning something. I don't know if you guys had a chance to read it, but I sent this thing out. And because Carl's always ranting about, you know, these people should go to jail in this industry and that, and how no antitrust laws. And A guy named Russell a couple weeks ago said something about 1789, which I remember, which was the French Revolution. The question in the email was, how far have we advanced? I use the term advanced, but how do you even talk about antitrust laws when the only people who remember them are 60 years old and older? I mean, ever any kind of enforcement? And how do you even tell somebody who's 30 today that, hey, the stuff that Amazon's doing is blatantly wrong antitrust-wise or something along? I mean, what is their even frame of reference of when this stuff was even thought to be illegal? I mean, right now it seems like on virtually every level, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. And I think, I mean, how do you even, suppose we get, God knows, Solomon comes back from the dead and becomes the next president and says, I'm not going to be X-ing things all day long or whatever I'm doing. I'm just going to actually sit here and work all day long, and I'm going to go solve all these problems. How do you even start? Because I don't think people even know it's a problem. You know, what's the matter with this? With there being one company in this business? Well, there's a lot that's the matter. But it's hard for me to even explain it to people. It's been so long. How does anybody even know that it should be a different way? I mean, I know it's a kind of a weird question, but I don't know how do you mention today to somebody that, boy, this medicine shouldn't be vertically integrated. The hospitals shouldn't own the doctors, shouldn't own the insurance company. They look at you like, why, what's wrong with that? That's all I've ever seen. It's sort of like, you know, Major League Baseball. What do you mean? Why shouldn't it be a monopoly? It always is. Well, why should they be? Why should they have a monopoly, for God's sake? They are interstate commerce. You know, football. Well, what do you mean? There's always been a draft. I love the draft. But wait a minute. Why does somebody, 30 people in the industry, get to choose a guy and he can only work for that place? They don't even know what I'm talking about. I mean, how much of what we're trying to solve, and all of us are trying to solve the same thing, we can't even paint the picture for people, can we?
No.
How do you start with that? What would you do if it was Larissa president? How would you even start that?
Well, I'd like to talk about the Amazon platform. I feel like I'm one of the very few people that don't shop on Amazon. And I've made the comment that I don't like shopping on Amazon because, for me, the interface is very hard to use. If I'm looking for a product, and if I don't have enough information about the exact specific product that I want, I very much struggle looking at all the different choices. Amazon makes some recommendations. They throw in things that I don't understand, and the algorithm for me personally doesn't work. And my sister and my brother-in-law, they work in user experience, and they've explained to me that Amazon's platform there for shopping is actually very terrible. But what's interesting about that is that even though it's terrible, people use it because that's what they're comfortable with. They still go online and shop on Amazon, even though that there could be better things out there, just because they're so familiar with how Amazon works that it's not worth switching to a different platform to buy their goods. So part of the problem with your arguments right now is people have become so conditioned that this is the way it is, and most people don't like change, and so they're not even willing to consider an alternative that may be better because of how complicit and complacent they are with what they're using at the moment. And for those who are unfamiliar with my shopping habits, I love Costco because Costco does a lot of the pre-selection for me, and I'm usually looking at two or three choices, and it makes shopping that much more simple for me. And again, I don't mind Amazon when I have the specific specs of the product that I need. But if I'm just browsing, I struggle browsing on Amazon.
Well, how much of this is connected with the, if you buy the Prime, you think you're getting a deal because you're getting your service for free? And I'm going to say, from antitrust law, the idea that you got to pony up for Amazon to watch a basketball game is a direct violation, I would think. But does anybody even know what I'm talking about?
Well, TV is another one of those interesting things that have changed with time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, we got a couple minutes, guys, but the unemployment report last Friday. When, if ever, are we going to get the people who comment on this stuff to society to zero in on this unemployment rate when it's kind of not even really the number? Last month, for instance, according to a household survey, we had 200,000 less people working, 220, and we put 220,000 people in the column of not working. And that column was split out two times. One is for people that are actively looking for work, which is 7 million, a little over, and people who aren't, which is like 105 million. But if you look at the total number, it's growing every month. And yet, as long as you somehow make the fake and say, well, a lot of these people aren't really looking, and keep the unemployment rate down, it sounds like we're doing okay, but sort of we're not. When are people going to wake up to that? Just my first class in economics at Notre Dame, I walked in and a professor said, the unemployment rate is the most useless number there. You got to look at the stuff behind it. And here it is 50 years later, and people are still quoting the damn thing. What is it, just me obsessed with this, or what's going on here? Larissa, you're...
Well, I was talking about this earlier. And that the number to really be paying attention to is the labor participation. You know, how many people are actually participating in the labor market, as opposed to that percentage numbers. And I do think a lot of people look through that now.
Okay.
You hear them talk about it on the business networks for sure. And when I look at my Bloomberg and I see, what pieces of data they're highlighting that are coming out of the employment number, labor participation, if it increased or decreased, definitely is a number that they're talking about. And that number is probably going to be flat for a while because of the immigration stuff, which means the unemployment rate could be going down, even though the employment situation isn't getting much better at all.
Well, in December, that number you're talking about...
You and I talked about the same thing in a slightly different way.
In December, the participation rate was 59.7, January 59.4, February 0.3, March 0.2, April 0.1. When is that the danger zone? I got to believe 55 is. Now, we're talking about the amount of people that are working versus people that aren't. Now, a lot of people that aren't working are in school or they're in pensions, so you don't have to worry about it. But a lot of them are being, to a certain extent, paid for by the people who are working. Where do you think the danger number is here, both of you guys? Then we got to go. I don't think it can go much lower, do you?
When do you think 50-50?
Oh, I think if it's 50-50, we're 1935.
And that's definitely a danger zone.
I'm going to say, boy, I think we better arrest it long before then. I was going to say 57. We got to really be concerned. But Larissa, what do you think?
I'm in agreement.
I mean, it's hard to point. I mean, if somebody retires with, $40 billion because you've got all kinds of stock, he's no strain on the system. But in general, you don't want that. You'd rather have more people working, right? I mean, traditionally, if you go way back, where did this thing used to be? It was, in 2006, 2007, we're talking 63%. And I think, what did Carl say? A 0.1 is like 30,000 people or something? It's a lot. So are you guys all done with finals? Are you still doing them, or what are you doing?
Yeah, I've wrapped up finals.
Good for you. So are you teaching?
I've got two online this week.
Then
that's what I'm crossing my fingers and hoping they work.
You guys doing summer school or no?
I'm doing some summer school.
At the campus or online? You got to still be in
I'm doing summer school on campus.
Well, good for you guys.
And at the med school. And in Chicago at the CBOE.
You're one of the few people left?
So there. No, I'm doing for the graduate school, I'm doing a half-credit class called Chicago-Style Finance, and we're going to go see the people at the Fed. We're going to go see people at SIBO.
Wow.
We're going to visit with the CFA Chicago people and visit a few firms, and I think we're going to ring the closing bell at the SIBO.
Hey, good for you. Good for you. Well, hopefully I'll see you. We're wandering around, and Maybe Florissa's around. We'll see.
I might bring them by to you, or maybe I'll get you on the list to ring the bell. We'll see.
Okay. Well, both of you guys, thank you very much. SP Futures up 3 just after the PPI number. Sent us down. Now we're kind of back to unchanged. Well, NASDAQ's still up 110, but it was up 2-something. PPI number was lousy. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.